which is sort of where we find ourselves speaking about these various seemingly unrelated subjects. Writer Whitley Strieber has had a lifetime filled with amazing, inexplicable, absolutely terrifying encounters up close and personal. And his experiences were first told in the blockbuster hit book Communion, was also made into a movie. You know, you remember that book, that face staring out from the cover of the book. It resonated with people. It struck a nerve with people. I know it did for me. And it, I think for millions of people, it seemed strangely familiar. Unleashed floods of personal encounter stories from all over the world, hundreds of thousands of letters that went to Whitley and his wife. And it is told through the prism of alien abductions. That was sort of the context of the time when it came out. But what the truth for Whitley has evolved. His wife, his partner, his muse, the voice in his ear, the voice of reason, his wife Anne, lived through it with him, helped him understand it, and she's still doing it, even though she died a couple of years ago. In this hour, we'll hear the personal experiences of my two guests, Whitley Strieber, Jeffrey Kripal. Jeff has been there for some of this himself. We're going to hear about that right after this. Whitley, let's talk about Anne. So she was so important to your work, a partner, and helping you understand these strange experiences that you've had for so long.
Yes.
But she died, and then she didn't. So can you share with us sort of when it first became clear to you that she was still around and was still communicating? And then I'm going to get Jeff's story on how he saw pieces of that as well.
Okay, well, it was about an hour and a half after she died, and that's when it started. And I was just devastated because my listeners are, and my fans know how close we were. We were, in fact, we were so close that I still wear both rings. As I think of us as still being married, but we're down to one body now. Anyway, she died at about 7:20 on August the 11th of 2015, and it had been a long struggle. We'd struggled together with this disease, this cancer she had since 2013, and I was exhausted, and she had died, and I was sitting in the living room just drained and devastated and thinking to myself, oh, my God, honey, if you still exist in any way, I sure need to hear. And the phone rang, and I thought, a phone call, the last thing I want. Nobody, just a couple of friends basically knew about it at this point. And it was a friend, not one of those friends, a lady who is a psychic. And she said, Whitley, the strangest thing just happened. I just heard Anne's voice in my ear telling me to call you. Is she all right? And I was floored. I thought, my word, that was quick. Thank you, honey. And I said to her, I'm sorry to tell you, Annie died about an hour and a half ago. And there was this silence, and she said, well, that doesn't surprise me. I'm a psychic, remember? And she said, Anne's trying to get in touch with you. And I thought to myself afterwards, after the call, that was so extraordinary. And then that night, she showed up, and it was like she was walking toward me, and she'd been paralyzed. She couldn't walk, and she was walking toward me with this very intent look on her face in my mind's eye, but walking and very looked like she wanted me to see her, that she was able to walk again. And it went on like that. There were quite a number of other experiences, but they didn't, you know, they could have been my own mind. So I wasn't completely convinced at that point. But the next thing, what happened next was two friends, Trish and Rob McGregor, who were writers also, you may have even had them on your show, I don't know, but they write mostly about synchronicities, were in their house, and Trish was actually writing a blog, but this time everyone knew. It was a few days later that Annie had passed. And she was writing a blog about Anne, and suddenly there was a huge explosion in the house, and there was no explanation for it. There was none at all. And she thought that it had something to do with Anne. And I said to Trish, I said, you know, you were writing about her but ignoring her, and she probably was right there. And as you will recall, Annie had a temper. I think you just experienced a little bit of it. But still, that wasn't, that could have just been a coincidence. The fact that there was no apparent reason for the explosion didn't really prove anything. But then I was sitting out on a bench in the hills above Palm Springs, and my kids had gone hiking, and I was out there and just sitting there just thinking, oh, Annie, I just wish you were sitting on this bench right beside me. And my cell phone rang. I was in cell phone range. There was nothing miraculous about that. And I answered it, and it was Claire Henry, the writer William Henry's wife from Nashville. And she said, Whitley, I just had the strangest thing happen. I just heard Anne tell me to call you and tell me she was all right. Tell you that she was all right. And then I remembered back in the 90s, Annie said, came out of her office one day when she was reading all these letters, in fact, that Jeff now has possession of because they're all archived at Rice University, I'm happy to say. But in any case, she was reading letter after letter, and we were getting letters like in huge masses from the post office, boxes and boxes of them. And she came out of her office and she said, Whitley, you know what? This has something to do with what we call the dead. And at some time around then, we decided to make a pact that the one of us who died first, if possible, would come back, not directly, because neither one of us is going to believe that. I mean, I would have believed if Anne had come whispering in my ear, I would have thought it was my imagination. Despite all of the things that have happened to me, what people don't understand about me is that I'm terribly congenitally skeptical, which Jeff knows. But in any case, we decided that the one who died first would attempt, if possible, to come back to friends. And with them, no one knew this pact. We talked about it for half an hour maybe and forgot about it, frankly. And I had forgotten about it until this phone call from Claire Henry. Then I realized, my goodness, she's doing the pact. It's the pact. This is what's happening. And at that point, I decided that I would try to figure out what the heck stuff like channeling is all about, which I have never been much of a believer in. But so much has happened. Annie and I wrote the book, The Afterlife Revolution, together because I learned how to communicate with her, and I still do all the time. But what Jeff has, and I think it's time at this point to go to the Cheryl Black story, Jeff. And if you, that's all right with you. Because it advances this another step.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jeff, how about
I mean, I can tell this. Yeah. George, you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, please.
Well, you know, I knew Anne too briefly, actually, before she died. Whitley and Anne came to a number of conferences that I hosted at Esalen, and then Anne passed away in August of 2015, and Whitley asked me to come to the family house and do one of the readings. It happened to be a medieval mystic named Meister Eckhart that Annie loved. So I had some connection to Anne. I wouldn't say it was a profound one in any sense, but I certainly knew Anne and admired her. What happened was in December of 2017, so this was a little over 2 years after she had passed, I got an email from a correspondent and a friend named Cheryl Black, who happens to be a very gifted medium who lives up in Canada. And she she was asking me for help. A lot of people ask me for help, but I'm always in the position of not being doubtful that I can give any help. And in this case, Cheryl was asking me about this, essentially this ghost, as she called it, that was showing up. And it looked like Princess Leia from Star Wars, and it kept bothering her. She was trying to crochet stuff for Christmas and cooking Christmas cookies. And Charlie's very funny and very lighthearted, and she was kind of joking about this ghost, but she was also very serious, and she wanted my help with it. And she told me that this ghost had drawn a picture through her own hand of her face, of the ghost, and she just thought it was a picture of Princess Leia. And to be honest, I was too busy, as I always am, and I just kind of put Charlie off. I just didn't answer the email, and Charlie got, you know, kind of, I think she was a bit upset with me, and I eventually got back to her, and I looked at the drawing, and I still was drawing a blank. And at some point, I showed it. I think I asked Shirley if I could show it to some friends. And so I showed it to Diana Pasulka. And Diana said to me instantly, she said, "Jeff, that's Ann Streber." Huh. And I was like, "Holy shit, you're right. That's Ann." And so then I asked Shirley if I could show it to Whitley Streber. She did not know. She knew who Whitley was, but she didn't know Whitley. And so I showed it to Whitley, and he, of course, immediately recognized that it was based on a photograph. It actually his favorite, one of his favorite photographs of Ann, and he then showed Charlie and Diana and myself now the drawing and the photo, and they line up perfectly.
Perfectly.
So there was this...
The photo wasn't in the public space, as far as I know.
Yeah, so what was happening is that Ann, I think, was using this very intimate social network between the four of us to sort of manifest her presence in some way through this medium in Canada, who's particularly gifted in this way. But then what happened, then it got stranger still. I kept looking at the drawing, and I was playing around with it on my computer, and I noticed that the word Anne, A-N-N-E, was effortlessly written all over this drawing. It looked like there were dozens of these. You couldn't actually see it when you just looked at the drawing. You had to darken the digital copy or look closer. And then it's patently obvious. And I pointed this out to Whitley and Diana and Shirley, and none of them were aware of it. And Whitley then pointed out that this was a clear message from Anne. It was sort of one of these smoking gun messages, because Anne had loved this artist named Al Hirschfeld, who drew cartoons for The New Yorker and intentionally put the name of his daughter, Nina, in his drawings. And then he would sign his name and put how many times the word Nina appeared in the drawing. And Anne loved to just look at Al Hirschfeld's drawing and count how many times Nina showed up. So this is exactly what she had done with this drawing. And so this went on, this story I just told you actually extends over, I'd say, 2 or 3 months of social interaction. But it was a dramatic event for me personally, because it very much felt like Anne was trying to communicate with us in a very indirect and very symbolic and frankly artistic way that was persuasive to the four of us and meaningful. And that's just the story. That's what happened.
And there's some wry humor in there as well. Whitley, you're convinced.
A lot of humor, yeah.
Whitley, you're convinced there's no way that that photo was known outside your home. You don't think so.
I'm convinced of that, because there's so many pictures of us on the internet. But I didn't see that one anywhere, and I don't think we've ever published it. I looked for it on Google Images after this happened. I did not find it. It might be there now, because it's been up on my website side by side with the drawing since. But no, I'm pretty sure that the image was not, that Charlie didn't copy the photo. Anyway, she's not the kind of person she's not deceptive. She wouldn't do that, I don't think. It's not her style at all. She's a good person, let me put it that way. I've gotten to know her pretty well. In fact, I'm going to have her on Dreamland in early September. She and Jeff are going to come. We're going to have a great time together, because Shirley is a brilliant psychic and also a very funny person. So it should be
She's awesome. Also very funny. I mean, humor, I think, comes through her as well. So, yeah.
We'll come back and talk about Anne in a little bit, Whitley. Jeff, while we still have you here, have you had, you've traveled with Whitley. You've been to conferences together, stayed together. I don't remember if you've been to the cabin, but can you share, is there any other examples or incidents that jump out at us that we should know?
Yeah, there is actually. I mean, there's a number of them actually. There's a number. The one that I think is the most dramatic and the most interesting, though, I've had Whitley to Esalen a number of times, and the way we put people up, people have to room, they have to double up into rooms so we can get them all in. And I often will put myself, with some hesitation, by the way, in the same room with Whitley. And I'm like, oh, God, here we go again. You know, I'm going to have to sleep in this room with this radioactive shaman, and God only knows what's going to happen this week. And so sure enough, one week we were there. I don't know what year it was, Whitley. It wasn't that long ago, though.
A couple of years. I think it was 2018.
Yeah, and Whitley at this point still is in the discipline of getting up at 3 in the morning and meditating, doing the sensory exercise.
Which I do, still.
Yeah. He learned in the Gurdjieff Foundation. He gets up at 3 in the morning and essentially communes with the visitors through the sensory exercise. And, I knew he does this because, I mean, I'm in the same room with him, and I sometimes see him get up. And one night before he got up, my mind, essentially, inside my head as I was in this sleep state, split into two, and I could hear very distinctly the one part of me say very clearly, oh my God, in a kind of stunned, really awed fashion, as if there was some part of me witnessing something going on in the room that I had no way of even processing. And it was as if there was something so dramatic that I had split in two, and one part of me was watching this and commenting on it, and the other part of me was pretending or actually being asleep. It was unclear to me what I was doing, to be honest. But I had clearly split into two. And then a little later in that same night, I heard an explosion or something crashing. I thought Willie had knocked over a light or a lamp or something. I mean, it was loud. And I woke up and there wasn't anything there. And the next morning I got up and I, of course, shared both of these experiences with Whitley. And he then, you know, launched into this explanation of what had gone on with him and the visitors. So, again, I had this sort of indirect participation in something he was experiencing in a much more dramatic and a much more real way. I often describe myself as a spiritual dud compared to Whitley. He sees things and goes places I don't go and I don't see. But I clearly did pick something up that night. There's no question about it.
We're going to go to a break in about a minute here. I do want to get into your regimen, Whitley, because you work at it. These things don't, I guess they do seek you out at times and have over the years, but you also work at it to...
Absolutely.
To foster an understanding and to reach out and actively try to communicate, which is a central message of this book, A New World. And there is a sense of urgency that I haven't heard from you before in your works. And we're going to get into the reason for that coming back. You know, you look at the world right now, and if you watch the news, if you read newspapers, you know that things are pretty messed up. All over the planet. I don't just mean the virus. I mean, what's happening to climate. And I know that's still a hot button issue for a lot of people, but the world is changing, whether we care to admit it or not, whether it's a partisan issue or not. There's a New York Times article came out today. It was in the Sunday edition, this massive project that they've been working on for a long time about what will likely be the largest migration of humans in history, caused by climate change, making large parts of the world uninhabitable or tough for people to survive, grow food. It's coming. And You know, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago before the break about a sense of urgency that I detected in Whitley's new book, A New World. These messages that he's getting from the visitors that have been with him for so long. And you got to believe, well, we'll ask him about it, whether or not what's happening to our planet is part of that. The assumption for so long is that these visitors are from somewhere else, that they come from other planets. And over the decades, when you hear close encounter stories, frequently the people who are contacted say they get these alien editorials where the visitors, whoever they are or wherever they claim to be, tell us to take care of ourselves, take care of our planets, our planet, and warnings about atomic weapons, things of that sort. A lot of folks will laugh those off, but that's sort of been a consistent message from the visitors, and it makes you wonder, maybe they're not tourists, maybe they live here. We're going to get into that with Whitley Strieber and Jeff Kripal right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Whitley, let's talk about urgency. That seems to be what I got out of A New World, is that these messages you've been getting from these visitors, what you call the visitors, the pace has quickened in recent years. And is it related to what's happening to our planet?
Undoubtedly. Back before I knew they were in my life, the last book I wrote before the communion experience was called Nature's End, and it was a novel written with a friend, Jim Konietka, about the environment collapsing. And you know, it's got a lot of science fiction in it that didn't work out, but it is basically correct. And if you read it now, it's incredibly eerie because it has things like the burning of the Amazon and things that are actually happening now. And I have often wondered whether or not they began to emerge into my life in about maybe 19, into my consciousness earlier. Because in fact, if you look at my two first books, The Wolfen, which is about a pack of super intelligent wolves, and they're gray and they have big eyes and they're hyper intelligent and they are predators, but they're very careful only to prey on people at the peripheries of society. And then of course the grays are sort of predatory, and they're kind of like that. And then the next one is this eerie blonde vampire called Miriam, and who is kind of like the blondes that are in the sort of UFO universe also. And then Nature's End comes along, and then the visitors burst into my life. And one of the earliest memories of that happened in October and comes up in the first hypnosis session with Donald Klein, is me seeing the world exploding and bursting into flames. And, you know, you look at what's happening now and you think to yourself, well, you know, the Arctic's on fire. Right now, we don't think about these stories much because we're too busy with COVID and political upheaval and all of that stuff. But in fact, there's fires all over in Siberia and not in Alaska, I don't believe, at the moment, although there may be. And so all of this stuff is kind of happening. And another thing that may have come from the visitors recently, and I say may have because I'm never sure. Sometimes I am sure. I take that back. But this is one of those things where I felt like I was told that when I was asking about coronavirus and if they could help us in some way, that this would not start to come under control until December. And the specific phrase that I think maybe did come from them was, and your world will be forever changed. And, you know, I wanted to know, why don't you help us? If you want us to survive, why don't you help us? And the answer was, and this is probably is from them, we would never steal your fate. And that gets to something in a new world, which is about cultural colonization. And if you go way back to 1977 to a little article in the magazine Science by two distinguished astrophysicists, D.B.H. Kuiper and Mark Morris, speculating about if aliens, real aliens, which we were speculating whether or not they even existed a little while ago, were here, they would almost certainly keep themselves hidden. And the reason is that the only thing they could get from us, if they were capable of traveling the stars, that would be of any value would be our sense of newness and innovation. And so they would conceal themselves, because the second they appeared, we would totally and completely turn toward them. And it would be like what happened when the British showed up on some isolated island in the Pacific in the 19th century. The local culture was just blown apart because everybody, all of a sudden, they wanted the guns and the pots and pans and all the cloth and all that stuff. They didn't want their stuff anymore. And their culture and all their beliefs and their whole personal evolution ended. And this has happened all over the world to one indigenous culture after another. And I don't think they want that to happen to us, but I think they're in a real bind. Because I think that if they don't show up, we might end up really in trouble here. I mean, serious trouble. And when I say show up, I don't mean necessarily land on the White House lawn. And I'm not even sure, as we were talking about earlier, that could happen. But I mean show up in such a way that we know there is more out there and that it does have a message for us. And the message is you better clean up your act and fast. And that, I think, might be in the process of happening with these disclosures and so forth and this it's not disclosures, but the whole thing is becoming more focused with the New York Times stories and the Navy Department revelations. And I think it's likely to become more so over the near term, hopefully.
Jeff, let me ask you, because you're here for another 15 minutes. Are there comparisons in religious studies, similar kind of messages delivered by different beings or supernatural figures in different faiths, where they tell us, hey, you got to clean up your act and get things together? You know, you look at the evidence of what's happening around. There are people you can't even talk to about it. They don't want to hear it. And, you know, as Whitley just described, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world. Brazil on fire, Australia on fire, everything, ice meltings, you know, it's a mess. So have there been comparable warnings in other faiths when people were a lot closer to the earth and who, you know, paid attention to what's happening in the earth, and a lot of the supernatural beings had a connection to the earth?
Well, I'd say three things, George. I mean, I could give a long lecture here, but I won't. You know, the first thing we have to remember is this is probably the first time in human history in which we're globally connected by telecommunications and satellites and modern science, and we can kind of grasp something this big going on, this what one of my colleagues, Tim Morton, calls a hyperobject. We can start to grasp climate change. I don't think we could have grasped it, the size of it, any other time in human history. And yeah, the short answer is absolutely. This is in some sense what a certain kind of religion has always been, is a warning and a challenge to the people in power. What we think of as prophecy, for example, really probably originates in the West in ancient Judaism. And the prophets were these fierce, fierce social critics who took the kings and the people in power to task for the injustice of society and the way the poor were treated and the way the marginalized were treated. So there is this fierce prophetic strain in Western religion that I think is really important here. I think probably closer to our own present, though, is the rise of spiritualism in the 19th century, which turned to technology like we are at the moment, turned to magnetism and electricity and the telegraph, and basically proclaimed that the dead were about to show themselves, that we now had means and technologies and ways to contact the other world, and that the veil was tearing, as it were. And so, you know, when I hear this same, basically the same message from Whitley, I can't help but think that this is, you know, a fairly modern way of being religious in a kind of non-religious way, and that it does have precedence. It's not new. It's not absolutely unique, although in some ways it is new in terms of the telecommunications and the global village we all live in. I think we have to recognize the newness, and we have to recognize that it's not new at the same time.
Seems like you working with Whitley is a great fit, like hand in glove. Can you share with us how you came to into his sphere, how you guys connected, what it was?
Yeah. I mean, it's a fairly simple story. I mean, I finished a book in 2007 on the human potential movement in California. And when I was writing that book, I kept running into people who were telling me about these encounters with UFOs or abduction stories or near-death experiences. And I realized I really had no way of thinking about those things in my own field. And so I set about to write about these issues and to figure out why we couldn't talk about them. And I end up writing two books, one of which is called Mutants and Mystics, which is essentially a study of science fiction and the paranormal and why the paranormal has gravitated into the entertainment industry, into comic books and science fiction. And it actually ends with a chapter study of Whitley. And while I was writing that book, I asked a mutual friend of ours to introduce us. And I got to know Whitley and shared with him what I was writing. And, you know, that was about 2009 or 2010. And then the relationship sort of developed from there through multiple conferences and meetings and a friendship. And I share your conviction, George. I think it's a very fruitful, and Whitley's not Jeff and Jeff is not Whitley, but they somehow work together in really, I think, really helpful ways.
And then one last question for you, since we're coming to the end. You know, you're a professor of religious studies at Rice, one of the great universities in the country. Do you still have physical science guys, engineering professors or colleagues who are not happy about you delving into even weirder stuff, because B, they're not sure that the university should have religious studies on the curriculum to begin with?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot, George, and it's usually framed in, you know, how do you deal with the pushback? And my quick answer is, what pushback? What I mean by that, I think a lot of intellectuals, including a lot of scientists and engineers, are frankly in the closet on this one, by which I mean they're secretly supportive, even though they won't talk about it in public or they won't study it, you know, with their own resources. The longer answer is that there's a politics of knowledge, there's a sociology of knowledge, both in the broader society, but also in the university. And essentially how that works is the sciences like physics and chemistry and biology are on the top, and that's where most of the money and funding goes. And then the social sciences are kind of in the middle, so anthropology and sociology. And the humanities are on the bottom because we study squishy things called human beings that can't be manipulated or measured. And on the very bottom of the humanities is the study of religion. So we're somehow almost under the ground, I think. The general rule is the higher you go in that hierarchy of knowledge, the less you can say about these paranormal topics, because you have so much status and you have so much to lose. The lower you go in that hierarchy, the more freedom you have to speak about things like this, because you actually don't have a lot of status or a lot of things to lose. So I'm kind of on the bottom there, and have a kind of freedom. You know, having said that, most people in my field won't talk about these things either. So I'm probably presenting too positive a picture there, and I'm probably underestimating my own marginality and my own radicalism. But the short answer to your question is I've gotten a lot of support, frankly, from my colleagues and from the academy. And
oh, good.
I think it's because people want to talk about these things, and they just don't want to talk about them in ways that will embarrass them. And they see me as someone trying to forge new ways of talking about these things that make them comfortable and yet also kind of push the envelope.
You know, I just have to interject here that Jeff's modesty is so appealing, but the fact is he's a rock star in his field, okay?
Oh, well, thank you, Whitley.
It's the truth and you know it, but you'd never say it.
Well, I was wondering about religion and how it fits into the discussion we're having, whether or not 1,000 years from now there'll be a new religion based on the Book of Whitley and the Book of Elizondo. And they'll be recalling the tic-tac, sort of comparable to Ezekiel's chariot. I mean, that's what you get from a lot of critics of these kinds of subjects is, the reason we're all pursuing it is because there's a hole in our heart. We're really seeking God, and this is a substitute for that.
We have to dimensionalize it carefully and correctly and place it in the culture in such a way that that does not happen, because it's trying to happen. I think the critics are quite right.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff Krampow, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for staying up late. I know you're not a night owl, but I appreciate you being here. And I hope you'll keep us in mind whenever your next project comes out, whether you're collaborating with Whitley or not. And thank you again for being here.
It's an honor, George. And I'm sorry I have to leave, but I have to get up in the morning and go to work. So
understood.
You guys carry on.
All right, Jeff Krampow, thanks for joining us. So we'll be back talking with Whitley Strieber about some really unusual experiences that he details in this book, A New World, direct encounters with a range of different kinds of visitors and beings, and his continued interaction with his wife, Anne. We might have a special guest call in as well. We'll be right back.